From KUOW in Seattle, this is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. When you think about country music, places like Texas, Appalachia, and Nashville probably come to your mind. Maybe you even know about the Bakersfield sound. But the Pacific Northwest has a long country tradition, from honky-tonks in Tacoma to radio shows in Walla Walla and dances at Whatcom County meeting halls. Washington State's mid-century country-western scene is at the center of a new novel by journalist Stephanie Clifford. It's called The Farewell Tour. The book follows washed-up star Lillian Waters as she heads back home to Walla Walla as part of her final tour. On the way, Lillian must confront her alcoholism, a career-ending health issue, and her memories of a fractured childhood. The book is steeped in cameos from country stars and artists you may never have heard of, but who deeply influenced the genre. And author Stephanie Clifford says the legacy of country music in Washington was a surprise even to her.
I grew up in Seattle, been a country music fan since I was in high school, but I became a country music fan when I went to Arkansas for a summer. So I came back, it was like height of grunge, and I was listening to Tammy Wynette.
You had been converted.
I'd been converted. I drank the whiskey. But I didn't think that there was anything to do with Washington, that country music had much to do with Washington at all. And when I started researching this book, I knew I wanted a fierce Western woman in it. I knew I wanted her to be out in the world kind of dealing with art or with her creative expression in some way. But I really struggled with, like, well, what should that be? I love reading obituaries. So I was reading an obituary that mentioned a country producer out of Washington State. And I was like, what? And I started looking into it. And there was this moment in the 50s when Washington was this thriving center of country music. Tacoma, wow. Honky Tonks, Buck Owens, who is this incredible Bakersfield Sound founder, was up here running a radio station in Puyallup. Don Rich, who was a beautiful electric guitarist, was then like a high schooler doing the honky-tonk circuit. His mom would wait outside while he played, which I think is amazing. Loretta Lynn was out here for her husband was a logger, worked in timber, so she was out in Whatcom County. They were all playing and singing around Tacoma, which is just wild to me. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to get the main character, Lillian, to Tacoma so she can be part of this scene and start shaping this Washington sound.
Yeah, I love the way you are really painting a picture of Tacoma neighborhoods as she's walking through from her waitressing job to, you know, the various gigs and her job at a radio station. These radio stations in Walla Walla and in Tacoma really play a central role in Lillian's journey to the music business. Now, Lillian's able to get a job as a girl singer on KUJ in Walla Walla and KVI in Tacoma, which folks will likely know today are talk stations.
Right.
What was their role in that scene back in the 1940s and 50s?
Yeah, so these small radio stations back then were the local entertainment. They didn't record. They just needed to fill up the days with whatever they could find. Hence, somebody like Lillian, who talks her way onto KUJ in Walla Walla when she's, I think, like 13, 14. Girls like that were allowed to go on the show because she had a guitar, she could sing, and they were like, fine, you can come on and do the farm show in the morning at 5 a.m. And so she comes on with her guitar, she sings some songs, she doesn't know what she's doing, but that was like a way that a lot of people got started then and started getting their music out to people and started getting on the air. And same with KVI in Tacoma, where she gets a job right before World War II starts, and she's actually there when news of Pearl Harbor comes through on a quiet Sunday at the station and has to cover for her drunk host and jump in and start singing to the crowd just to cover airtime.
Mm. The Farewell Tour is set in the real world. I mean, you mentioned Loretta Lynn, of course. It still blows my mind that she started her career in Custer, which is like up near the Canadian border.
Yes.
It's just a little community there. Of course, Dolly Parton, Tammy Wynette. What women in the country music scene at the time became Lillian Waters for you? What inspiration did you draw on to make this character?
It was so much fun doing the research because I knew sort of the big singers, Dolly, Tammy, as you mentioned, Loretta. But I didn't know some of the smaller ones who never really got the fame and didn't go to Nashville, stayed on the West Coast. So Jean Shepherd, who did go to Nashville, actually, but she got her start in California. She's an incredible singer who got her start at like 16 as a girl singer on the road.
Big midnight special, shine your light on me. Big midnight special.
So she's got this wonderful voice. She makes a cameo in the book in Nashville where she's giving Lillian some advice that Lillian doesn't take but ought to. Rose Maddox is another one. So I hadn't heard of her at all before this book. And she's this wild country singer from Alabama, rode the trains west with her family to work as migrant laborers during the Dust Bowl, and got her start at 11 fronting her brother's band, and sang from like 11 and basically until the day she died.
Oh, those lonely teardrops falling down, down, down like rain.
If you listen to her sing, you get a sense of what that West Coast sound was and how different from Nashville it was. So in Nashville at the time, her contemporaries would have been like Patsy Cline, Kitty Wells, these like very smooth-voiced, calm-sounding women singing about mostly domestic life and love. And then you've got Rose Maddox up on stage, like hooting, hollering, yodeling, like singing about being drunk. There's electric guitar in the background. It's such a different dance hall, kind of like after a long day sound, and it's fabulous.
So there was really a split between the East Coast and West Coast sound.
Yeah, and a real rivalry, which Lillian takes on full force. She is so envious of Nashville on the one hand. On the other hand, just really wants to prove West Coast dominance in music, so has a chip on her shoulder about that.
And so this is the point in the 1980s when country is beginning to cross over into more of a pop realm, and we're laying the groundwork for modern country stars like the Carrie Underwoods or the Miranda Lamberts. Mm-hmm. I just think of like Dolly Parton and Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette. These voices seem timeless. But was there a certain crisis or disconnect when these sounds from the classic country western music genre were kind of like meeting the synthesizers? I mean, when Lillian is talking about with the journalist in the beginning of the book, talking about these pop acts, she's very critical. Did that occur in the 80s when people were sort of like, ugh, it's too pop, it's too mainstream?
It did. Yeah. There's always been a real sense of what is country and what should mm-hmm. country be. And Nashville, of course, got to determine what that was. And so Nashville at the time was pushing these pop acts. But I think a lot of real country stars were like, not real country stars, but a lot of country stars were thinking, this ain't me. I don't sound like this. This doesn't sound like the stuff I grew up with. And it has very little, you know, there's no mandolin, there's no fiddle, there's no walking bass. For a listener, I think it sounds very pop. Mm-hmm. And that was upsetting certainly to Lillian, to a lot of her cohort. And so she is trying to fight back a little with some of her more classic music.
Talk to me about your own background in music, because, I mean, we are talking about, in the novel, major and minor chords. You know, we're talking about finger picking technique. There is a lot of musical technique and detail, music theory, that goes into this narrative. Are you a musician yourself, or did you just do a lot of research to bring that authenticity?
A little of both. So I grew up playing piano, and I can play by ear, which means I can pick out most of the songs that I mentioned in the book. So I was picking out Tammy Wynette songs. I was picking out George Jones songs. I was picking out kind of earlier fiddle Appalachian songs on the piano, and getting a sense of how structurally they worked and how Lillian would have understood them. She's not classically trained. She kind of picks this all up on her own as well. And I play guitar. And I wrote several songs that are in the book. I wrote music and lyrics for them, which was it was just a blast, honestly.
Had you done that before?
No, I hadn't. Well, I hadn't. And it felt really freeing and fun because I'm a professional writer. I'm a journalist. Like, all the words that I write have a certain weight and attachment to me, where the music, I was just like, let it go, have fun, like sit down with the guitar, pick it out, work on it for a few days. And I also wanted to describe accurately what Lillian goes through as she writes the songs. I think often, or sometimes in books, in movies, it sort of like fades into a montage and you see them like writing away and it's so easy and happy.
It just flows.
Yeah, it just,
you know,
flows.
Just kind of comes down from heaven.
Yeah, and in fact, it's like writing is this really like ugly, sweaty process. And so I wanted readers to see Lillian kind of being like, oh, that doesn't rhyme. That doesn't work. Like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
So there are a few scenes of her writing where she's kind of just balling up things and throwing them out, which is what writing is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my understanding that your grandmother grew up on a Depression-era farm. How did you integrate the stories that you'd heard from your grandmother into Lillian's early life?
Yeah. So my grandmother left her Northwest farm at age 10 to move into town and become a hired girl. And that was basically all we knew of her youth. Mm. She got herself to UW at 16 and from then became a nurse in the war, and her life sort of went on from there. But in that generation, people did not talk about hard youths. They didn't talk about what would have happened to make her leave at age 10, and we never knew why. So I was incredibly close with her, but she just wouldn't discuss it. She would just say, like, well, I had to leave, and that was that. And from age 10 on, she supported herself. Mm-hmm. And I think I knew this as a child, but it didn't really hit me until I was older. Like, what on earth was that like?
And and what was it like for her family to let her go?
Right. Yeah. Right. And for her to know from age 10 on that she's kind of on her own. She's got to strike her own path, and she's got to be tough as nails. And I think there are so many stories from that generation, especially of women who just kind of had to accept and abide by whatever was going on in order to survive. Mm. So I wanted to tap into that with Lillian's story. She has the same. She also leaves home at age 10. We don't know why until the end of the book. And see what that does to a person. How do you carry yourself differently? How do you interact with the world differently? Like, Lillian has this hard, hard shell, in part because that's what she needed to get through. And at the end of her 1980 tour, after some engagement with some of her fellow musicians, after kind of thinking about the way she's lived, she softens a little and allows the world in a little bit more. And it's a real change for her for the first time to trust the world and to examine her past and to look at what happened to her. But that wasn't the standard approach for women of that generation. So it remained this mystery. My grandmother died, and it remained this mystery as to what had happened there. And this was sort of a fictional starting point.
And it's terrifying when you have had that shell your whole life to let the cracks happen and let the world in.
Exactly. You think the tighter you hold on, the more protective of yourself you are, the better it will be. And her fellow musicians on the 1980 tour, particularly Kaori, her fiddler, who's young and has a totally different attitude about examining your past, and Charlie, who you mentioned, who's her lifelong friend who comes on the tour, push her to reexamine that mm-hmm. and see what is it like if I engage with the past a little, if I face this thing that I'm afraid of.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Lillian's fiddle player in the novel is a Japanese-American woman. Her name is Kaori, and she confronts Lillian both with her own just innate skill and dedication to music. And I think that Lillian sees a lot of herself in Kaori, but at the same time is frustrated by her modern sensibilities and maybe the ability of Kaori to bring, I deserve this, or I, like, of course I should be part of this world sense to playing with Lillian as a 1980s woman versus what Lillian had to go through in the 40s. But then, of course, there's race overlaid with that because Kaori is at the same time, again, Japanese American, and her family had to deal with the internment of Japanese people in the United States. And she confronts Lillian about her complacency at that time. Why did you want to include that relationship between Kaori and Lillian? What was important to you about that?
Kaori was a really interesting character for me because at first she was just a member of the band, like, didn't have a big role. And she, as a character, she just kept insisting on, like, she had more to say. She kept interacting with Lillian. And I was like, oh, Kaori's actually going to be a big character in this book, which I wasn't expecting.
Like, she can sing.
She can sing. She is writing. She's not just this. She shows up and Lillian, who's kind of road weary and tired already at the beginning of the tour, sees her, and she's like some almost teenager with like long hair and no bra. And Lillian's like, oh, for God's sake. Like,
she's so bright eyed and bushy tailed.
Right.
You can just feel Lillian just being like, ugh.
Yeah, like, I am tired. Sit down. So Lillian doesn't give her much credit at the beginning. But she sees then Kaori practicing and Kaori fiddling and Kaori writing songs. And Lillian at the time is stuck. She hasn't written songs in several years. And so she and Kiori start to talk about, well, how do you write a song? And where do you write a song? How do you find time for it? And she starts to develop, like, I would say at first a grudging respect for Kiori that then turns into real respect. But Kiori is also pushing Lillian. Kiori's her family was in Kent, Washington, during World War II, and was sent to Tule Lake, a detention camp in California. And Kiori wants to visit the camp on the road, and it's near where the bus is going. And Lillian, it's this generational divide where Lillian's like, but it's upsetting. Like, why would you face something upsetting? And Carrie's like, no, that's the point. Like, you have to face it. You have to talk about it. And Lillian, I think, really doesn't understand that until she sees Kiori at Tule Lake just standing in the dirt, kind of making this makeshift memorial of rocks. And Lillian's like, oh, in facing it, there's strength. There's something that is giving Kiori purpose and almost a freedom in facing this and talking about it.
Much of the story is driving towards this homecoming that Lillian is looking forward to on her tour. She's gotten to a point in her career where she's on the downslope, and she has this image of her sister in Walla Walla, Henrietta Hen, who in Lillian's memory was very cruel to her. They had a really strained relationship growing up before Lillian fled the family. And Lillian's idea is she is going to sweep into Walla Walla and she is going to just show Hen the woman she's become, the performer she's become, and look at me and oh my gosh. And I don't want to spoil anything in the book, but what were you trying to explore when it came to homecomings and memory and the way that we process trauma when you were depicting what happens between Lillian and Hen?
That's a great question. I think sometimes we hang on to these images of almost revenge, of like, I'm going to show them, I'm going to show up at the whatever, college reunion, be a soccer star, whatever it is we have in our minds. And getting that outside affirmation never really does the trick. So Lillian, her whole life has been, she has this line that where she says, it's always been Hen that I'm singing to. And always in the crowd, even though Hen can't possibly be at these performances, she's thinking of her sister. She's thinking, does she hear me on the radio? Did she hear my interview? Does she know who I've become? Can she then reckon with the fact that she treated me so badly? And I wanted to have Lillian have to face that and almost have to build from within, what if I don't get that chance? What if that homecoming isn't what I expected and Hen's not who I expected? What then, if I've been like building toward this my whole life and certainly this whole tour, how do I fix that? And I was reading a lot about trauma. I was reading The Body Keeps the Score, which is an excellent, excellent book about just kind of trauma staying in the body. And so much of that went into Lillian's character and her movements. Like Jean Shepherd, the great singer, hugs her at one point in Nashville, and Lillian just freezes. She can't be touched. She can't move easily through the world.
Yeah.
This trauma is really wrapped up in her.
Before we go, are there any albums that helped you in your writing process or in your researching process that you want to maybe recommend to listeners as a companion to the novel?
Yes. And I should mention, I also made a playlist at Spotify.
Perfect.
So it's on my website at stephanieclifford.net. So there are so many good ones, because one thing I wanted to push back against, too, is this idea of country music as only white and rural and Southern. And in fact, the first song Lillian hears that she falls in love with is a Ma Rainey song, Bo Weevil Blues. I picked that one in particular. It worked time-wise. It came out in 1923, I think. So Lillian could have heard it on a neighbor's Victrola. But it's also, like, she lives on a farm. She knows precisely what boll weevils are. It makes sense to her as a song that boll weevils would bring you the blues. And there are so many blues influences and jazz influences. She loves Charlie Christian when she's learning electric guitar.
She's listening to those in the archives of the KVI
exactly.
Radio station.
At the record library, just like this one little part over and over, being like, how is he doing that because electric guitar is still a very new instrument at that time. She loves Bill Brunsey. She tries to do a version of his John Henry when they're on the road in 1980.
John Henry said to his captain, "My man ain't nothing but a man. Before I let your steel..."
And then there are newer albums that by 1980 that she and her bandmates are arguing about. They love Emmylou Harris's Boulder to Birmingham, which is Lillian's vote for the saddest song, and I think probably mine.
I don't want to hear love song. I got on this airplane just to fly.
The men in the band love old paint. I was thinking of the Harry Belafonte version, but the men all just, like, start crying at old paint.
I ride an old paint. I lead an old Dan. I'm going to Montana for to throw the hula hand.
And Lillian's like, it's a horse dragging around a dead body. Like, what is so sad about that? Like,
what
about the
horse?
What's wrong
with you guys? Well, thank you so much, Stephanie Clifford, author of The Farewell Tour. I'm enjoying the book so much, and I've enjoyed discovering more country music through your writing. So thank you.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.